Hi, Kyle. This is Heidi Lowe. I am a jeweler. I, you know, try surfing here and there. And everyone I love is a surfer, so this is where I come to you. But I have to say that I have never sent another podcast more places. Like, I literally share this podcast all the time with all of my favorite people, and it's so stimulating and so fun to listen to, and I love all of your questions, and I so appreciate it. So thank you. Bye.
Heidi Lowe, you're too kind. You're too kind. I really appreciate you sending the voice memo in. It's great to hear from people who listen to this podcast. All of you beautiful, invisible, clearly like-minded people who I don't know, but you know me. And the only way that I get a little window into your life is when you send me these voice memos. So it really does put a smile on my face. So if you're listening and you have a cell phone, just bust out your voice memos app, record about a minute of audio. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from, some details about your surrounding, and then email it to info@kyle.surf, and I would love to play it. info@kyle.surf. Thank you so much to Santa Cruz Medicinals for sponsoring this podcast. They sponsor each and every one of these episodes, and they make potent CBD. They're the ones who help me prioritize this podcast, bring it to you every single week amidst my full-time job and fairly busy life, which is making these little getaways, these little surf explorations, that much more valuable. I will say there's something interesting that happens when you start working really hard, where it makes the time off feel more pleasurable, makes you feel like you earn it. And for that reason, this trip to the Shumagin Islands in Alaska was really one of my favorites yet. It was very unique in the way that we were super far out there. There were no other surfers the entire time that we were on this trip. There was just the people on the boat. And I think, felt more of like an exploration than many other surf trips that I've been on. And we spent days stand-up paddleboarding to shore. We got really fun waves for 2 days. But beyond that too, I had a chance to connect with a buddy of mine named Steve Hawk, who organized the trip. Steve's a writing mentor of mine. And I wrote a story about this trip, which is going to be coming out shortly. So if you just sign up for my Substack, tierman.substack.com, that story about this trip will be dropping very soon. But Steve helped me craft it, and it the whole trip, I've come to reflect, felt just as much like a writing retreat as it did a surf trip. So I got a little two for one. Thanks, Steve. And yeah, it was just a damn good time. Alaska is pretty freaking far out there, and the water was about 40 degrees. So thank you to Patagonia for supplying a warm new wetsuit, because I would have been screwed without it. And this is a podcast that I did with captain of the boat, Mike McEwen. Mike and his wife, Wendy, charter the only multi-day surf charter in Alaska. They go through the Shumagins. They go through a few other island chains as well. And you can go to alaskasurfguides.com to check out more of their details. They really just are two of the happier people I've met. Mike has been he worked in a cannery for a long time in Alaska. He grew up on Oahu, and then came back to surfing later in his life. He's surf stoked. He's doing it right. And, I hope that this conversation with Mike inspires you to get off your bum and go explore the world, because it's big, life's short, and surfing is fun. So without further preamble, please welcome to the podcast, Captain Mike McEwen.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of El Mali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
Welcome to the
All right, Captain Mike, I'd like you to start off with a story of your wife meeting Mick Fanning.
Oh, well, my wife is pretty starstruck, as you'll hear here, that we had the pleasure of having Mick on board and a couple other guys from their sponsor, and so Wendy was down in the galley BSing and getting to know Mick. It was just the two of them in there, and our last name is McEwen, so she asked, well, what's your name? And
she didn't know who he was.
Was a surfer dude that was coming out with us. So she says, my name is Wendy McEwen, and Mick responds, Mick Fanning. And that kind of perplexed Wendy, and she looked at him and, well, Mick Fanning, what's your first name? And he got it through to her that Mick was his first name and not part of his last name.
McEwen McFanning. That's so great, man. And how long have you guys been doing surf charters out here in Alaska?
Boy, this will be our 10th year of actually getting a little bit of income out of it.
Right.
And it's been a slow organic growth, to say the least.
Yeah, it seems like you're almost kind of hesitant to grow too fast. Like, I remember Steve was telling me that you'll even interview people before you decide to bring them on board, because, it's not like a massive ship where everyone is isolated in their own deal. It is really like you're bringing a family into your home for a week, so you want to make sure that you like them.
Yeah, that's quite true, and especially in the early days where we only had a few trips available to us to make. Had a real job to kind of sponsor the surf gig, and so you want to have a trip that's one that you want to go on, and then if you want to go on it, you want the people you're with, you want to be around them. So yeah, I would do quite a vetting process with about all our customers, try to get them on the phone as soon as possible to either continue the conversation or just end it.
And is part of that setting expectations?
Yeah, I like to be honest in what we have going. Surf expeditions or surf trips are it's a roll of the dice. We have no control over the weather, but we do have control over our effort
and attitude,
exactly. And then we've been hooked up now with Scotty Ryerson there with Alaska Surf Guides, and at first we were a little hesitant, and we moved into that slowly because now he's becoming the vetter of our operation, and we found he's up front and kind of deals with people the same way that we like to.
Right. So what does a conversation like that sound like?
Well, when you get someone that says, I want to surf perfect left point waves.
Should say, go to Chile.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
We're not going to drive by any of them. And there's some we know of, and there's some that we haven't even found yet. So, do you want to go look for them? Then we're in. If you want to be guaranteed them, you might as well do something else.
Right, right. So we're pretty far up and out in Alaska. So It took me a little while looking at the maps to see that we actually miss a lot of those big north groundswells that come down from the Aleutian Islands. Is that right?
When the patterns are such that we're sending the northwest swells down to the Hawaiian Islands and stuff, generally they're passing right through us where we are here. Mm. They'll start quite a bit farther west, and then they either head north, which then they miss us, or they head east, which is a little more common. And if they head east, they blow right through here, and we get a couple of 3 days of activity. And you know, like earlier in the spring when we were here, you know, it's just one after the other after the other. And then high pressure set in, and we got all these bluebird days that we had on this trip.
Right, right. And you'll even get south swells up here. It's just so crazy. I've never surfed this far up in the north, so just getting to see how far those swells track has been really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, and we're learning more and more about that. And we used to have a very valuable tool. There used to be a buoy out on the Shumigan Bank here, and it's been down for like a year and a half. But it would at least give us, with a grain of salt, an idea of what's going on. That yes, there is a 4 foot 20 second south swell coming, and that's why there's surf pumping and none of the local forecasts are calling for it.
Right.
But we don't have that anymore, so we just got to take one good look before we leave town at different sites and see what happens.
So I want to back up a little bit to where you grew up, when you started coming to Alaska, and then ultimately made the move up here. So tell me a bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in a military family, and most of my younger life, you know, high school and below, was in Hawaii on Oahu. Dad would get stationed there every other tour of duty, the way it worked out. So I was born there and then eventually graduated from high school there and spent another couple of winters later on when I quit college. Came to Alaska when I was a college kid, and I got invited to come work at a fish processing plant in Yakutat. And I came up for the summer, and you know, we worked our tails off, small plant. Everybody got to do everything, and I realized, God, I'm making enough money, I can go back to Hawaii and surf all winter.
Yeah. So were you out on fishing boats?
No, I was on the shore. And the first year, and then the second year, the company moved to Bristol Bay, and they had what's called a tender, which is a larger boat that would go out to the fishing grounds. And this is for salmon, and you buy the fish out on the grounds from the fleet, and then transport them to the processing plant. And they needed a deckhand on it, and so I'd get $50 a day to go out and work the opening on the boat, and I'd come back to the cannery and work on the slime line.
And is that where you're filleting the fish?
We were heading and gutting, but yeah, we're actually processing them and getting them ready for preservation.
And how long would that season last?
That'd go for almost 2 months. Bristol Bay is fairly quick. It starts off slow, and then it gets really crazy, and then peters out.
Yeah. You enjoy it?
I did. I've always wondered, like, I've spent, I think, 20 years in the bay, and it's kind of the most ferocious of all the salmon fisheries. You know, it's just so fast and furious, generally, that I thought I'd really miss it.
Yeah, you can make a lot of money in a short amount of time, and it seems like things are moving really fast. I don't know a ton about it, but I read The Perfect Storm, book by Sebastian Younger, and he just talks a lot about that fishing industry as something where you got to get it while the getting's good, and you can make a lot of money if you're there while it's happening, but there's also a lot of just risk and fast-pacedness to the whole thing.
And generally, you hear about all the success stories, and you don't hear about stories like our friend Jack here that went to the bay, and then he was dropped off here in Sandpoint, owing the boat money, and the guy just dumped him off, and yeah, here he is in some little village way out in bumfuck, and no money, no nothing, after busting his ass all season. And so that's the other side. Like I say, that's kind of the quiet side, and you know, Jack being resilient and an awful good worker, had no trouble getting on a better boat and carved out quite a lifestyle out here for him and his family now.
I was surprised when you said that Sand Point, which is where we set off from, at one point had the highest income per capita of any city in the United States when fishing was just going gangbusters here.
Yeah, and it's a true story. First time I bought fish in this region was, 1979, ran a little floating processor, and we were paying $1.35 a pound for the salmon, and I don't think, a year or two ago it got up to that level, and it should be higher than that now, but you know, they went 20 or 30 years with it being less than that, and that was, you know, $1979 dollars, and not $2020 dollars.
So how many years were you making that annual pilgrimage up to Alaska from Hawaii and then back?
I just pretty much short stopped and worked in Seattle on the boats once I secured a position on a boat, and that was a processing ship. And let's see, I came here spent four summers, and then decided I should check out a winter here. And so I moved to Girdwood, the local ski town outside Anchorage, and by that time I'd pretty much dropped surfing and started skiing. And so I just ski bummed for the winter.
But you'd already attained the skill of surfing just growing up on the South Shore. That was your main thing growing up, right?
Yeah, I would surf South Shore until high school, and then surf North Shore after that primarily.
Nice.
And, got to see it through the whole history of the sport there, when the Bronze Aussies and, you know, Lopez and the whole gang, you know, we were in the water right with them.
Yeah. So then you moved to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And picked up skiing. When did you come back to surfing?
Came back to surfing basically on my 50th birthday.
And so there was like a 25-year hiatus.
Correct.
Okay, and tell me about your 50th birthday.
Well, we had just lost my mom, and just finishing up a divorce, and was living in Homer, where once in a while I'd see good waves, and once in a while I'd see a little body out in a good wave. So I was thinking about trying to surf again, but just talking like we all like to talk about shit and do nothing about it. And so on my 50th birthday, my sister and my dad bought me a board. And so it was, you know, put up or shut up time. And it took me about a month to figure out what a wetsuit was in this day and age. Last time I had surfed, you know, it was a 3/8 inch, 2-piece beaver tail bondage suit.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden they're all in millimeters, different thicknesses, different body parts, and finally found one on eBay that fit my budget, and started surfing again.
And were you working in fish processing plants in Homer?
That's correct. I'd built a plant.
You'd built a plant yourself.
Yeah.
Got
yeah.
it. And what kind of fish were you processing?
We would do Pacific cod, we do sable fish or black cod, we do halibut, and we do salmon. And and it was quite a busy operation for quite a while, and then the different resources and the markets started lining up where it really wasn't fitting our business model, and we either had to, you know, go big or get out.
Right.
And my partner is a couple of years older than me. Yeah, he didn't really want to go big. I pretty much had the family race and had a house. So I had really no reason to. And then we started tinkering around with the surf business. And so it's kind of a good segue or whatever the word would be of leaving one and picking up the other.
Yeah, it's cool that you've been able to make that transition out after doing something for so long. When did you actually move to Alaska full time from Seattle?
That was 1981.
1981.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. 82, I guess.
Got it.
I'm pretty bad with what year things were.
So 50th birthday. 50th birthday. You got the board. You got the wetsuit. You're in Homer. The fish industry is changing, and you're thinking, maybe I can get back into this and make it a bigger part of my life.
Yeah. I was surprised. I had to go down to San Diego to pick my board up at my dad's place. And, went out to Sunset Cliffs, got three waves and, in a crowd and really had fun, but, about killed me at hacking up loogies for it seemed like a week afterwards. The muscle memory was there, but nothing else inside was. And then came back up north and found that everything came back pretty darn quick. And then I was tail end of being a single dad of getting the kids raising out of the house and decided, well, shoot, with the property taxes, I don't need a big house, big yard, all that stuff anymore, I'm going to look for a boat, for a liveaboard boat. And that was my original plan when I found this boat, the Milo. It was going to become my home and just live in the harbor.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool that you've been able to downsize with grace. I think that a lot of people get addicted to bigger and more, and then even when they don't need to at a certain point in their life, they don't know how to downsize in a way that might make them happier.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think a lot of it is you need people in general. We need a challenge, and picking up this little occupation here. I mean, it's every day is a challenge. We never know day to day really what we're going to be doing. We got kind of an idea, but we better be able to get off that horse and get on another one when we look out the window. So I think that's really helped in the transition is, this is challenging and it's still involved. We'd be out here. We haven't seen any boats this trip, but during the busier seasons, like in the fall seasons, there'll be boats going by and I've probably bought fish from them boats and we can chat on the radio and I get calls from fishermen offshore, say, oh, there's a big swell out here, Mike, you should come out. So we've been able to kind of introduce the sport to, a whole different sect, but, their idea of a good wave is a little different than ours.
Sure.
A bunch of waves crashing into a cliff and lots of white water. You should come over here.
So when you made that decision that you wanted to downsize, you were planning on just doing liveaboard boat by yourself. Maybe you'd be able to explore some more of Alaska's uncharted waves on your own. You knew that you wanted surfing to be a bigger part of your life. But at that point, there was no real idea that you were going to turn it into a business.
Right. And really, there wasn't originally not that much thought on going surfing with it. And then it was right about when I came up with the idea that I'd start surfing again. And then I looked for, kept an eye on boats for sale for almost 3 years until, my last, until my son moved out. By that time, it started surfing. We started taking airplanes and looking for waves on the outer coast. And then our friend of ours, Scott Dickerson, pretty talented photographer and, savvy with internet stuff. He started posting pictures. And then when we actually got the Milo, then he started posting more pictures of places that we were driving by and surfing. And we got approached to take people out.
And when did you meet your now wife, Wendy?
That was right before I started surfing again.
Okay.
Yeah, about a year or two before that. And, you know, one of the things we did when we were dating was take kayak lessons, because I was starting to think, well, you can surf waves with a kayak.
Yeah.
And this gal's kind of seems like she'd be into kayaking. So, you know, so we took a kayaking class together, and where my ultimate goal was to go catch waves with that kayak. But, fortunately, that one didn't transpire.
but she did get into stand-up paddleboarding, and you guys get to share that together.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And she'd become quite a good boat person, you know, out of the blue, having zero experience, and enjoys it. She doesn't get the satisfaction that myself or the other crew members have of the surfing. So, you know, we don't want to burn her out. So she now has worked her way high enough up the company ladder that she can pick and choose what trip she comes on.
So will you tell me the story of how you proposed to her?
I proposed to her on when we were bringing the boat up from Seattle.
So you guys had found, so you were looking for 3 years for a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this would be a better place to start. Where did you find the Milo?
Found the Milo on Craigslist in San Francisco. And it was down in Redwood City. And I got a hold of the owners. I was trying to see if it was worth flying down to look at. And it's a couple of grand by the time you get a hotel and rent a car and airfare and food and all that. And the guys didn't know anything about the boat. And they had bought it from the original owner, the fisherman. So I threw the entry commission, which is kind of a regulatory outlet for fishing up here. I was able to track down the original owner of the boat, and talk to him. And he assured me that it was a solid vessel. And he had these yahoos from California bought it, and he went barking off about them. And that was kind of my opinion as well. So I flew down, and took me 2 days to get everything running. It was just tied up in the marina being rented out to college kids as an apartment building.
Really?
And so in 2 days, I got everything running during a heat wave in the Bay Area. It was like 95 degrees. I mean, miserable. But stayed on task and then made an offer, and they took it.
Okay. So you took it, and then from there, did you fly back up to Alaska, or were you ready right then to motor it up?
Nope. We made the deal and then left it there, paid the marina, and then basically I only had the winters that I could devote to it. So went down in November of that year, and which is 2009, and two kids from Anchorage, or from Homer and my dad, and I ran the boat from there up to Port Townsend.
Okay.
And then we hauled it out there and let it sit there until the next spring. And then we ran it from spring to Sitka, Alaska, and left it there until that winter.
And when did Wendy join you on the voyage?
She joined us after, from the Sitka to Homer part of the voyage. She had a week off of her job for vacation, and she decided to take her week and meet us in Yakutat, because we were planning on 7 to 10 days there. And of course, so I started thinking that I got some gal taking her vacation time to go to Yakutat in November to go on some old rusty boat, that I better not let this one get away, at least take a good swing at her. And so I got my bravery all up, and you know, ordered a ring and was gonna propose to her, which I did without the ring.
Tell me the story.
Well, I ordered this one's from the East Coast. This artist that makes I like his work, and he's supposed to mail it to the fish plant in Yakutat, who's the owner of it. It's a friend of mine, and so every time we'd go into town, yeah, I'd have to come up with an excuse to go up to the fish plant to check the mail. And we had all kinds of stories. We were expecting wetsuit booties. We were expecting this. We were looking for that. And got totally skunked. Never showed up. And you know, got a hold of people. No, we mailed it, and it hasn't come back. So yeah, it's kind of MIA. And so I finally just had to fess up to Wendy that I had a nice ring. I was going to ask her to marry me. And I guess the question's still there. And fortunately, she agreed and said yes.
And then you guys did the motor from I guess it would be from Homer to or from
Yakutat.
From Yakutat to Homer.
She stayed on board. We just hung out in Yakutat surfing waves there for a week, and then she flew home, and then the rest of us continued the voyage. And we left an open date as far as I had no commitment when we had to get married, just that we were committed to do it. And then finally, seemed like all my kids were engaged, and we thought, well, we should jump in front of them so that it's not quite so awkward at the weddings and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So that gave us a little nudge to finish the deal.
So then you retrofitted the boat.
Continually.
Yeah. Ongoing project.
Yeah.
And what was the first... what was the first surf charter that you guys did, and when was that?
The first charter would have been in, I want to say 2005 or 2006.
Okay. And was that with Ian Walsh and Travis Rice and those guys?
Yeah, it was a Red Bull-sponsored Brothers on the Run. The Jackson brothers were kind of the storyline of and they brought along Ian and Travis, and that all got tied into us through Scott Dickerson, who knew the producer.
And what did you guys do on that trip?
We did a Homer to Seward trip and looked for waves, surfed. We found some pretty decent waves outside of Seward. And well, they brought a jet ski, and they rented it. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to rent another jet ski from the outfit that they got it from by the time we were done with it. it was fun. It was very low budget. The deal was didn't cost them all that much, but they had to provide all the food. They had to do all the cooking. We just provided the vessel.
Got it. So that was not as much of a kind of a fully inclusive thing where you get the food for the guests and help set it up a bit more.
No, it was hilarious when they showed up in Homer because they came in like three big SUVs, and you could tell that they all went to Fred Meyer in Soldotna, which is about 90 miles north of Homer. And each group and each vehicle went in and bought groceries. I mean, there was just a shitload of stuff that was all 20 of one thing, nothing of another. it was quite an interesting pack out, I'll tell you that.
That's classic, man. Wow, so that was back in 2005.
Yeah, because we were married in 2004. It was supposed to be Wendy's, my first anniversary cruise, just the two of us.
Yeah.
And then Scotty informed us that he had this inquiry of taking these guys out, and we decided that might as well and see how it goes and see, which was kind of how we've put the boat together is you take a group out and you find out things that got to be more comfortable if we could do this, if we had that. And then things that I was going to do realize, that'd be stupid. And so we've been able to refit the boat as we used it, which kind of gives purpose to everything that we've done.
So what are some of the things that you've done to retrofit it? Like, obviously, the fish hold is the place where we put our wetsuits now.
Right.
The boards go up top here on the deck.
And we've added two old wheelhouses, one over the fish hatch and then the one on the stern for a separate salon. And that gives us a chance where between the wheelhouse, the galley salon, and what we call the Miss Piggy, the aft salon, three different places. So we find that people can be by themselves or we can be as a group. And over a course of a week or two voyage, it's nice to have those options. We put a hot water, self-adjusting hot water shower out on the deck. So when you get in from surfing, you can stick the wand down in your suit and came up with the idea to have the toilet mixing valves that in construction for putting in bathrooms to keep your toilet tank from sweating, and they're all cold water with a little bit of hot water, and so I got one of those and just swapped it around where it was hot water with just a little bit of cold water. So we just have the one valve, and temperature's right, and we're not wasting water waiting for the temperature.
And what brought you up to the Shoemigans, and when did that happen?
And
for people who don't know, will you just give a little bit of geography as to where we are right now?
We're down just about the western end of the Alaska Peninsula. So just at the end of the peninsula is where the Aleutian Islands start. And we're at the end of it, and it's a 20-island group that hangs down south of the peninsula. And so it's got exposure from the west, south, and east. And I've always, once I started surfing again and started looking around, this was very attractive-looking country. Tools nowadays with Google Earth and just the nautical charts shows you good anchorages and a lot of places that you look at. And so there's got to be a wave there. And then having Sandpoint here, we can get supplies, we can get fuel, we can get water, we can get groceries. So it fits the bill of what we're looking for.
Right. And how long is this stretch of islands?
It's about 90 miles, I think, diagonally across. So it's a lot bigger than it looks when you look at it on a map. I'll tell you that, especially going 8 miles an hour.
Yeah, it takes a little while to get. I mean, we went down to the southmost facing island to see if maybe we could get some bigger waves way down there, and it takes a minute to get all the way to the bottom.
Yeah, it's a commitment.
Yeah,
there's no doubt about that.
But I mean, even if you're not getting waves, will you talk about some of the wildlife that you might see on this island, Shane?
Yeah, so like this time of year, it's the start of the gray whale migration. So we were able to run in quite a few of those. The sea lions, I don't know if they're off the endangered list now or not, but from what I've noticed, they sure should be. it's rare that we have a session without seeing a couple come by. The birds are starting to return, puffins and murres and cormorants. Cormorants are here all winter. There's bison on beach. There's feral cows. One good thing about the Shoemigans is there's no bears on the beach. And people, oh, boo, we want to see a bear. Well, we can drive 6 miles across over to the mainland in the fall time, and you can see all the bears you want. They're in there catching their salmon. But it makes it for a good place for people to hike that's safe. And just tremendous geology here, variety, a lot of history. Remnants found, they're dating to 4,000 years ago. And they think there's even older, but just haven't been found yet.
Yeah, we went down on that one site to go look for archaeological remains, which is pretty bonkers to think about, these islands and living out here in this environment 4,000 years ago.
Holy moly, we think we're so tough. Okay, a bunch of wusses, really.
Getting into some 5-mil wetsuits. Oh, yeah, we're hardcore.
Yeah, come back and have a cold beer after our big exploration.
Yeah.
We didn't go to it, but just the way the weather was, there's petrified sequoia trees that those date between 3 and 20 million years ago. And this place has been here a long time in it. And having just one town, city, village, whatever you want to call it, that's active, it hasn't changed very much.
Sandpoint.
This whole Shoemigan.
Oh, the Shoemigan, yeah.
Yeah. So what we're looking at, it's pretty much probably what it looked like 4,000 years ago for these people.
Right. There's no humans on any of these islands.
No. there used to be, there's settlements. I think they were mostly fishing camps back in the day. But, yeah, that's a long time ago.
And this, there was a stint, too, where these islands were used for ranching. Is that right?
That's correct. There's, I think, three of the islands had permits and ranches going. And then it was turned over to a wildlife refuge, all the properties here, and a lot of the Aleutians as well. And the people either gave up on the ranching or else they lost their leases. You know, rumor has it that they had a lease safe to raise 30 head of cattle, and they had 80 head of cattle. But I say that's hearsay, but I certainly do believe it. It could happen.
But still, some of the cattle remain.
Right, and it's quite a valuable food source for the local people. It's their meat market, and they kind of want to keep it. And then the Park Service or Regulatory Service is supposed to return the islands to their original state. And of course, cattle are notorious for trampling down bird habitat and whatnot, but. So it's a bit of a quandary for everybody right. involved, but that you saw the birds here. You know, they seem to have wings and flippers and plenty of them, and they seem to find places to live still.
Oh, dude, yeah. Last night I went on a stand-up paddleboard at sunset. It was real glassy, and it was probably 9:30 at night, so just as dusk was approaching mm-hmm. around here, and I saw a hawk, an eagle, and a blue jay all just hanging out in a group of three, just staring at me from the beach. And those, the hawks, the hawk and the bald eagle gave, or the blue jay kind of gave context to just how massive the hawks and the eagles are out here, right. man. Yeah. I mean, you say that bald eagles are kind of like pigeons out here or something like that. There's just so many, but the bird is fucking massive, man.
They are. Yeah, when you're close to them, they can get kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
They come around our house quite a bit and roost up on the peak, and it's become kind of a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
Which is a little aggravating at time when you've been working all day and all you want to do is drive down your driveway and there's someone parked there
taking a photo of
take your pictures or
yeah.
The worst story on that is, yeah, the guy out there honking his horn. You know, it's about 11 o'clock at night. You know, still daylight, summertime. Yeah, you go, what the hell are you doing? You know, I want to see it fly. Yeah, well, can I have your address so I can go park in front of your house and honk my horn? You know, little courtesies, appreciate it.
that's good, man. And, you know, there's not a lot of... not a lot of trees on these islands. Can you explain a bit about all the vegetation that we're looking out here covering the island?
Yeah, not like some biologist could tell us, but it's very low to the ground vegetation. It's known that the Aleuts would call this particular part of the world the birthplace of the wind. So it's not real conducive to tall trees. There's a few that have been planted that have taken root, some spruce trees. And
what was the Aleuts saying, and who were they?
It's the Aleuts, the original Aborigine people, I guess would be the term there.
Out here on the islands.
Out here, yeah. You know, that you know, the 4,000-year-old, and you know, with ancestors directly tied into the people right. that live here now.
Is that A-L-L?
It's Aleut, A-L-E-U-T, like
Aleut.
Aleutians.
Oh.
Aha.
All right. Click, click, click. The Aleutians.
Yep. And so, yeah, between the wind and I don't really know the soil, but you just look around and, you know, we can see gray cliffs, and then there's yellow cliffs, and there's white cliffs, and then there's black cliffs, and there's brown cliffs. And, you know, this is a little 3-mile stretch we're looking at. So, you know, whatever kind of soil's under there, I got no idea, but it doesn't seem real conducive to, to big tree growth.
And how would the Aleutians travel from island to island back 4,000 years ago?
They had their what's called the bidarkas, which is basically like a sealskin kayak.
Okay. Right?
And so, yeah, they were quite the mariners traveling about this country, and they, you know, would hunt the sea mammals, the otters and seals and whales, and once again, pretty tough dudes.
That's fucking hardcore, man.
Yeah. You know, move their families in these little things, and if you see them, you can see them in the museums or hanging up at the airport or something. You know, it's not like it's some Eddie Bauer big packing kayak,
yeah.
A freighter kayak. Yeah, they're, you know, little flimsy looking things, but obviously very seaworthy.
Right. So when do you get your best waves out here? Or what conditions give way to it? Because, I mean, I know that might be a hard question to answer when, because the weather changes so fast out here. We've had a high pressure system on this trip, so it's been pretty darn sunny and nice. You know, we got one good day of waves, and the rest has been pretty small, but it's been, seems like, you know, pretty rare to have this many days in a row where it's just kind of calm, sunny skies, yeah, almost kind of feels like California.
Right.
What I was gathering from everyone when I came on the boat, and I was saying, oh, like, what kind of weather are we in for? They said, yeah, we'll see tomorrow,
right,
because the forecast changed so fast out in this part of the world.
Yeah. Generally, it's, to go back, fall and spring is when we've come here. I know in the wintertime, it's probably just macking. But then you got limited daylight and probably so severe that it would make things awful difficult. Yeah, you'd have your occasional day where there's still a swell and the wind would be tolerable. But well, generally, if the storms are moving, the Aleutian lows, they're going right underneath us here. And they'll blow up. We found in the springtime, we get more easterlies. And then the fall time, more westerly. So it's we're working pretty much different sides of the islands. You know, it's not a hard set rule, but in general. So, you know, the southeast and the southwest storms, or they start southwest and they work their way to southeast. And we just try to find places where the wind is manageable and find that there's a lot of spots where it is very manageable.
Right.
Where at first we might have, like our first trip, might have stayed anchor for 2 days because it was so windy. Now we know, well, we can just be over here and, you know, it's going to be light offshore for half the day.
Right. That's the nice thing about islands is if it's on shore on one side, you can just go to the other side.
That's always the theory.
theory works great.
Right. Not always the application, but for the most part, you're true.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about the seafloor around the Shumagins. You were explaining that to me in mariner's terms and what makes this island chain unique.
It's got a lot of good bathymetry. Once again, you can tell my pronunciation lacks, but a lot of rock reefs here, a lot of cobblestones, like the granite boulders that we've seen on some of these setups, whether they had waves or not. You know, it doesn't take much of a surfer's eye to imagine the waves rolling down, and the rocks are all really smooth, so you know they roll down quite a bit. And not too many beach breaks. We've got a couple that come in handy when there's not much swell. It's also very good for access hiking from them. The Aleutian Trench is, I think, 60 miles offshore. So there's, you know, like 30,000 foot deep water that's coming up onto this shelf that we're on. And it's, for the most part, still pretty deep, you know, a couple hundred fathoms up close to the shore.
What's a fathom?
6 feet.
Okay. And how do you, so is that a mariner's term?
That would be a mariner's term.
Okay.
You know, from measuring, like, line, which rope would be the other word for a line.
Right. How did that term come about?
From the original fathometers, which would be some guy throwing a string with a lead weight out in front of the boat, and then as he's pulling it up, you know, passing it from hand to hand as he coils it, and that's about 6 feet, you know, your arm reach.
Right.
And so that would be a fathom.
Okay. So there's deeper fathoms out off of the Shumigans than a lot of other spots.
Yeah.
Okay. Which allow swells to not get fractured as they make their way in here.
Right. They get generated a lot easier.
Got it.
You know, the period, you know, 14 to 16 seconds is a pretty long period swell for these local storms, but that's about where they'll hit. Maybe 12 to 16 seconds.
You'll get that long of a period on even local storms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just there's a lot of power in them because they're built up fast. They just don't have the fetch.
Right. So they're not those 18 second swells, 20 second swells that you might get from the south that are moving from so far away.
Same storm, but more travel time.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And what has what's happened, you know, just in the last couple of years, as far as it, ramping up what you guys are doing here and going from those days back in 2005 with Travis Rice and Ian Walsh guys, where it's like it's very much a trip once in a while, to now what I'm hearing from you and Wendy and Rachel, who's the deckhand, is that it seems like it's one after another these days.
Yeah, we've you know, come to the point where I'm stepping out of the fish business. And I can't collect Social Security for another few years, according to my wife. So I got to do something.
Yeah.
And we still need to eat. We still need a job. So it's, you know, hard to find a better job than this anywhere. And so, let's make a run at it for what, while, you know, there's a biological clock ticking. Yeah, I'm 66, and I can't do this forever, and I know that. But you know, when I can't do it, I want to be able to sit back and be satisfied that I went as hard as I could for as long as I could, and I'll be plenty content if that's the end results. So we, you know, have to build it up, A, for the financial reasons, and B is, you know, someone's got to do this. I've been waiting for 10 years after, you know, being accused of going to ruin the surfing up here. You know, we're still looking for some help.
Yeah.
And,
you say being accused of ruining the surfing up here. So do you think that people are worried that it might get crowded up here?
Well, that's, you know, sooner or later, historically, every place does.
Right.
But there's very few places that are so difficult to access as here.
Yeah, this is one of those places that I have a hard time imagining would get crowded, just both because of the weather. You know, it's not Indonesia where you're going to be getting, where you're, you know, a Mentawai trip, there's a pretty high chance that you're going to be scoring incredible waves. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, going to the Shumigans, there's obviously the potential to get really great waves, but I think you're kidding yourself if you're coming out with the expectation that it's going to happen. So you better be happy with, you know, as we've been, with stand-up paddling and fishing and hiking along this adventure.
Right. That's, you know, I view it, it's surfing as the carrot in front of the horse to untie from the dock.
That's a great way to put it.
And then from there on out, it's, you know, look out the window. It's whatever we find for the day. And but yeah, that being said, you know, we've surfed waves here quite frequently that I'd put up alongside any wave on the planet.
And I've seen some of those photos.
And you know, nothing's more fun than just sharing out with a handful of buds, you know, where you can hoot and holler and cheer each other on. You get so tired that you're jockeying for position to make sure the other guy's in the position to take the next wave because you want to rest a little bit more. You know, it's kind of the true essence, I think, of why we all started surfing in the first place.
Yeah. Have you always had the attitude of if not now, when? I thought that was very striking what you said about knowing that you won't be able to do this forever, but being content if you can say I went as long as I could and as hard as I could.
Yeah, it's a firm believer. What makes a person isn't what they talk about. It's kind of what they do. And we all have dreams. I like to fly to the moon. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But there's some things I can do, and so I should do those. And that's, I think, how we get our satisfaction.
Yeah,
is find out what we like to do and do more than talk about them. Do to the best of our ability. And sometimes it takes time. It's not like you go out right off the bat, but it's been a little effort to figure out how to do it, and be patient. And eventually, I'm a believer that you can make it happen.
If you notice that you're procrastinating on a goal, is there anything that you'll do for yourself to ensure that you're continuing on with a personal dream of some kind?
I don't know. What I found helps motivate me and keep me going is generally our crew's pretty darn gung-ho. Surround yourself with a few young people. I got my older surf buds as well, but it's just to have the young life around you keeps you young, keeps you motivated. We'll have our little contests and whatnot to keep going. And of course, I guess they got some competitive spirit because you can't let the kids have all the fun. And then bring in something that really surprised me is bringing in different groups. We'll run the trip, and by the end of a trip, I'm pretty well whooped. And a day or two to regroup in between trips, and then you get a whole fresh batch of people that are just stoked. Their eyes are wide open, and it kind of enables you to look at everything with brand new eyes again. I mean, it's the same scenery, but they're new eyes because of what the fresh people are bringing on, and that's been a real enjoyable byproduct of what we're doing. I really like it.
Has your attitude, this is a shot in the dark question here, but has your attitude at all been adopted from seeing other people become curmudgeonly and notice that you don't want to do that?
I don't think so. It's just like in business. I like to be aware of what my competitors are doing, but I'm not going to dwell on it. I'd rather dwell on what I'm going to do. And I think that's how I approach this business as well, that let's spend the time of making our own product better, getting more enjoyment out of it. If that answers your question.
It does. No, it's a really inspiring outlook on life. I was talking to John Rose, who's on this trip, the other day, and we were just kind of talking about what a legend you are and how just kind of unconflicted you seem in your life. You don't have a self-narrative of regret or conflict. You're just kind of doing the best you can with what you got, which is both motivating and pretty rare, So yeah, we've both really enjoyed being around your energy as well.
Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah.
Get a life.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of waves have been your favorite to surf around here?
Oh, empty ones.
Yeah, that's not too hard for you.
Oh, I'd like fast long walls. yeah, I'm getting slowed down enough on pop-ups, and, you know, just a natural deterioration that, you know, kind of fast, steep waves are a lot more motivating to get up and get going than slow, pokey ones are.
And what kind of boards have you been riding?
I'll ride, I guess they're called mid-lengths now. They used to be called mini boards. Yes, up for, I think the shortest board I'll ride regularly is 6'10". I got a lot right around the 7-foot range. I've kind of replaced the long board with a foamy just because they're easier to paddle. And then when there's no wind and you're not quite sure, it looks like you have to hunt around quite a bit for the peaks, and I enjoy taking a sup out. But I think every board's got a place. I kind of feel sorry for people that limit themselves into just one board. Yeah, I'd rather surf the same every wave, and the way you can do that is by just matching your equipment to the wave.
Nice, man. Well, shoot, man, I've really enjoyed this conversation.
We enjoyed the whole trip with you guys. You know, it was fun. I got to apologize for, you know, we did surf like 8 or 9 sessions in 7 days, so it's not like we didn't get in the water, but it definitely weren't the waves that we would like to produce for you guys. But you rolled with the punches, and we got to do some pretty cool stuff.
Oh yeah, man! I mean, the highlights of the trip for me were checking out the Shoemakins and hiking around on them. Mm-hmm. Like it's pretty rare that I've had a chance to, you know, go on a hike by myself on a deserted island up to the top of a mountain, and, you know, some of the spits and just the curvatures of these islands are pretty striking from above.
Right.
I was able to take a couple photos of that one island with the archaeological site where it was a big kind of bulging round corner with a huge mountain at the top, and then it sucked into this little spit where, you know, you could walk across the spit from ocean to ocean, you know, in maybe 5 minutes, and then it would just bulge out again to another huge mountain. Mm. It has a very the islands have a deceivingly tropical look to them.
Right. Yeah, the white sand is in places is whiter than white sand.
Yeah.
It's hard to look at when it's sunny.
Yeah. Right on, man. Well, do you have any final thoughts or last words to anyone? Any surfers out there considering to go on their own expedition of some kind?
Well, just get off the couch. you got to do that. You know, that's I kind of when I do my vetting process. You know, it was kind of, well, are you willing to get off the couch? And if you are, then places like this are your cup of tea. If you'd rather just sit there and stare at your computer screen and do nothing about it. And so real quick, I went with Alaska Surf Guides, you know, we get a lot of calls for work traits, which is a good idea. And you can't blame somebody for asking about it at all. So I kind of thought about it, and I told Scotty, I said, you know, let them know we do work trades, you know. You go to work, collect your money, and we'll trade you for a trip. it's pretty simple. Yeah, you go mow the lawns, or you do get some little side job, and we'd be happy to trade you.
That's awesome, man. Well, where can people reach you?
Probably the best source is through Alaska Surf Guides, and he's got a website, alaskasurfguides.com. I'm not sure what the status of our website Ocean Swell Ventures is, but we've kind of turned over the day-to-day bookings to Scotty, and he does a good job, and he comes and cruises with us, and he does it mainly so he can come surfing too, so, you know, we're all into it. He also offers 1 to 3 day helicopter flyout trips that are kind of novel. You get to fly over a glacier and surf a good enough wave, but for a one-day adventure, that it would be a fun activity.
Well, thanks for showing us around. This was the coldest water I've ever surfed in, and the most northern waves I've ever had a chance to experience. So appreciate you making that happen.
Yep. Like I said, it's really fun having you, fun watching you surf, and hope to do it again with a little bit more swell in the water.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you.
Yep. See ya.
That's our show. You can head over to tierman.substack.com to check out all of my writing, my weekly newsletter, weigh in on this episode, connect with other listeners. Everything that I do is at tierman.substack.com. Just click the link in the description below. Thank you so much to Mudwater for presenting every one of these podcasts. Thank you to RPM Training for sponsoring this show. You can head over to rpmtraining.com, type in the code name KyleTman to get 10% off everything. Get yourself a jump rope, everyone. Get yourself some at-home workout gear. And thank you so much to Santa Cruz Medicinals. They make potent CBD. You can head over to scmedicinals.com, type in the code name Kyle10 at checkout, and get 10% off all CBD. That's it for now. Get out in the water, whatever body of water you are closest to, lake, river, bathtub, whatever. I promise it will make your day better. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I will see you soon.